Howdy, folks. This is Scott Parker, and you're listening to Episode 7 of the ZappaCast for March of 2012. We're continuing with our Dweezil Blockbuster special that we began in Episode 6. You're going to hear the remainder of my conversation with the one and only Mr. Dweezil Zappa. And once again, we'd like to thank Dweezil for giving us a very generous amount of time. I'd originally asked him for only a half hour, and he gave us an hour and a half plus, so that was just really, really spiffy of him, and we're very, very grateful. And what can I say? The rest of the episode, we're going to hear a couple of tracks from the new Dweezil Zappa album, FOH, which is now available at DweezilZappaWorld.com. Dweezil's website, which is a collection of front of house mixes, which are basically soundboard mixes of a number of Zappa Plays Zappa and Dweezil Zappa Plays Zappa concerts from 2006 on. I think it's a must have. It's a pretty incredible selection of material and very, very worth your while. We're going to have a couple of tracks from FOH on here. We're going to have a very special Zappa's Gear with the Professor Mick Eakers, and we're going to have the news with the Reverend Greenaway, as is our custom here at ZappaCast Towers. But for right now, without once again any further ado, here is part two of my interview with Dweezil Zappa right here on the ZappaCast.
I wanted to ask you, like, about arrangements and things like that, because one of the big rumors, and I know that you probably won't be able to comment on this one way or the other, one of the big rumors that's going around at the moment is that there are going to be more early Mothers material in the sets maybe this year.
Yeah, and that's definitely true.
Oh, it is true?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, anything you'd care to discuss?
I mean, there's. I did a lot of listening to all the early records because, you know, since 2006, we've played through a lot of my own personal favorites, and my own personal favorite era is, you know, is really sort of 1970 through 1979. You know, so we focused on a lot of stuff in that time frame, and there's still going to be things that we'll play from that time frame, but I did want to mix it up and add some more 60s and some 80s stuff into what we're doing. And so on this February tour, Scott Tunis is going to join us for the shows that we're doing here in California. And I was talking with him about you know, what were some of his favorite songs from the 60s and some of the stuff that he did in the 80s with Frank. So I wanted to gauge what he already knew and what he's interested in, and I was asking the band the same. And I, on my website, was asking people for ideas of things that they wanted to hear. And it was interesting because a lot of the things that people were asking about were a lot of the things that I was already interested in, and there's, you know, I don't want to give away any of the surprises. Obviously, when we go out and we play it, you know, people are going to know about it, and it's going to be on YouTube in 5 seconds. But the whole idea is that for this year, we're going to sort of do 60s, 70s, 80s, and mix it up in that regard a little bit more. Texturally, and I think it's going to be pretty cool. One of the songs that really is high on my list, and I've been working on it and listening to it a lot, is Mother People.
Ah, yep. So maybe my favorite song, maybe.
It's a great, great song, and to the best of my knowledge, it hasn't been played, so.
Frank played it briefly with Flo and Eddie in 70, but it was a very odd arrangement. You know, it was a lot slower, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And would you attempt something like that as it appears on We're Only In It for the Money?
Yep.
Wow. Because, you know, that seems almost impossible to do because it's so, you know, it was obviously tape manipulation sped up, you know, very speed kind of stuff.
Yeah, the vocal text texture and timbre will change a little bit, but the music side of it, we can get the texture close. The hard part is the little classical piece towards the end, because that's going to take some time to transcribe if we can't find any charts or anything. The process that we go through to do all this stuff ranges from our own transcriptions to charts that exist, and then also listening to master tapes to listen for parts that we can't discern if a mix is too dense. It's a level of diligence and commitment that we have that sets this band and this project apart, because we have the access to that stuff and we have the desire to present it in that way. We don't just go, well, I guess it's this, let's just do it like that. A lot of people will try to learn a part and they can't play it right, so they fix it to what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just not something that we ever do at all. We don't just say, oh, well, we can't play that, so let's just do this.
Ah, I see. So how is working with Scott Tunis been? It's been a while.
We haven't started rehearsals yet, but I'm sure it'll be fun. We've had him guest a few times, on different tours here or there, just for a couple songs. And his enthusiasm for joining us and for what the band has accomplished is evident. He's really positive about all this stuff, and that's one of the things that really helps come across to the audience when you're playing. If everybody is excited about what they're doing, the audience is going to be excited about what they're seeing, and that's the goal. Every time we go on stage, is to really give the music a chance to be heard. We have a lot of fun along with all the challenges that go with this, and every night it's different. But, it's still always a very positive thing, and we're never up there going, oh, here we go again, this is on autopilot. That just doesn't happen with Frank's music. You can't be on autopilot. There's just too much stuff to that requires, total attention.
Yeah, Nate, it's good for you because you do not have the problems with that I am aware of with personal behavior issues that Frank had to contend with, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s.
Well, yeah, that kind of stuff is something people don't take into consideration when trying to keep a band together. Personality issues are one thing, and then you have substance issues, that's a whole other thing. That's something that Frank didn't tolerate. I certainly would never tolerate it. And so you take those things into consideration at this point, because, you're going to be living in close quarters. Touring is not super glamorous. We're on the road with a hotel maybe once a week. We're basically always on the bus. You're showering at venues, and, mm-hmm. It's a grind. That whole traveling side of things is, a few steps up from camping. But it is what it is,
Yeah, I was going to ask you, since Tunis isn't going to be the permanent bass player, as we know, mm-hmm. he's not going to stay, are there any hints, subtle or otherwise, that you want to give our wonderful listening audience out there about the identity of the new bass player? Because I think you're looking at somebody, right?
Well, I have somebody that has already started working on learning the tunes, and he's very qualified. He'll be introduced and announced at some point pretty soon. But the thing that's great about his background and ability is that he's a good reader. He's familiar with a lot of the scores of some of the classical stuff. So it gives us a chance to have another diligent person involved in keeping track of the parts and arrangements, especially when we try to move forward into some more complex things. You know, things that are on the radar, things that I'd like to learn are things like Sinister Footwear and Strictly Genteel, and you know, you need all the parts for that. You need to look at those scores and make sure they're accurate. You know, there can be mistakes in those things, and I'm not a great reader, but you know, some of the people in the band are very good at it. So all that stuff takes time, and it's good to have an extra set of eyes and somebody with that kind of skill that can go through that. You know, that's why Scott was you know, leading rehearsals and stuff for Frank. It's, you know, Scott's a really good reader and knows a lot about all that kind of detail in the scores, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting that he was the Clone Meister, of course, for 88, certainly. But you don't actually have, you know, really anybody in the band who takes on that Clone Meister, because you kind of all are.
We're all responsible for our own parts.
Yeah.
I generally will imagine if we make any changes at all in some of the instrumentation, it ends up being, you know, things that are added to a guitar part. Some of the things that I like to do is you know, if there's an orchestral piece or an orchestral section of something, rather than have multiple parts played on keyboards that all end up becoming chordal, I like to have certain individual lines brought out so that it sounds more like a smaller ensemble of other instruments. You know, so our version of Rollo and some of the other things that we've done that have those kind of arrangements, you know, everybody has their own unique part. You know, it's all something that's written on the score, but it's everybody's playing their own part as if, you know, they're holding down the fort for that that one texture. So, you know, it ends up sounding more orchestral that way, as opposed to, you know, you might be able to have a lot of parts covered just by one keyboardist who can play, you know, multiple things because they got 10 fingers going on. You know,
yeah.
You got different things you can add in with different samples, and you know, I don't always like to do it that way because I like to utilize what's within the band. But ultimately, when we set out to do a particular arrangement, I might have a certain vision for something and want to make something have a slight bit more of a rock edge here or there than say, you know, a jazz edge. You know, sometimes I will just make a slight tilt in the timbre of the instrumentation for some stuff, just because that's my feeling of, you know, like I want a little bit of extra energy for something, you know. So you know, I think that's the kind of stuff that I oversee, but everybody usually ends up, you know, picking apart from the record that's like, okay, yeah, this is what's going to work for me. I can do this and this, and then we just start picking it apart from there, saying, all right, I'll fill in this part. This part is generally the most heard part by this instrument, so, you know, we don't usually switch roles. You know, like if something was you know, a horn part, it doesn't become a keyboard, piano part, you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, that's interesting, because I watched you guys work over at a soundcheck rehearsal, Cletus, and it was the only time that I was ever really able to, I was able to understand at that moment what some people said about Frank. Some of his musicians would say he could hear one note off in, you know, 1,000 notes, let's say. He could hear, you know, one note off and then stop the band. See, when you guys were playing that, sounded perfect to me. But there was one part I remember that you didn't like, I think. Something sounded off to you, and they just kept working over that one part. And it was that attention to detail that I think that, you know, sets you above, you know, whatever anybody else could do is, you know, in terms of effort.
Well, I think that all of us in the band are policing our parts, you know, and trying to do it the best possible. The difference that Frank had, too, was that a lot of times he had people that were trying to make their own additions to the music, you know. So if they were given a part, you know, they might say, oh, I want to re-voice this chord, or I want to do this. And if Frank wanted it voiced a specific way each time, and they start messing with it because, you know, they want to draw attention to themselves in that role, then, you know, he had a lot of that to deal with certain kinds of players. And you know, I haven't had to deal with that, fortunately, because, you know, people take their cues from what it is that's on the record, and they want to play it the way that, you know, I'm asking them to play it. And they don't really ever try to change it and say, oh, yeah, what if I did it like this? You know, they just know that the part's there for a reason. And so for that, I've been lucky because everybody just does what their, you know, job description is.
Yeah, it's interesting because Frank used to say that he felt that some of his musicians treated being in his band sort of like, you know, higher education. Whereas you have, you know, a group of people who really want to play the stuff and, you know, play it to the best of their ability.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the industry was different at the time that Frank was doing all this stuff. So a lot of people would look at the opportunity to be in Frank's band as okay, if I do that, if I have one semester there, then I'm clearly going to be off on my way to this illustrious jazz career or whatever they're, you know, trying to do.
Yeah.
And didn't really work out that way for a lot of people, you know.
That's true.
It's a frustrating experience for Frank as a band leader. You rehearse people, you spend all this time, and then suddenly you got to do it all again because somebody leaves after one tour or two tours, you know.
Yeah.
So the investment of time and money, you know, you have to be a very patient and organized person to see the big picture on all that stuff, because a lot of people would just quit, you know. A lot of people would say, well, I don't have a band anymore, that's it, you know, this is ridiculous, I'm not going to do this again, you know, it's too much trouble.
And now we're going to break away from our interview with Dweezil for a real treat for you here on the ZappaCast. This is a version of Brown Shoes Don't Make It, which was just released on the FOH album by Dweezil Zappa, which is available now at DweezilZappaWorld.com. Go there, get it, you'll never regret it. Right here on the ZappaCast, Brown Shoes Don't Make It, Dweezil Zappa.
Oh,
Yeah, it's interesting. How are you able to, because you have a sizable band, and Frank had combos that ran, sometimes 5-6 pieces in the group. How are you able, now I know that the reason that he did that was it fit his needs at the time, whether, mostly musical reasons, but how are you able to continue to have, in this day and age, a large band non-subsidized on the road in the way that you are? Is it difficult to do that economically?
It's very difficult to keep it all going because, obviously we're in one of the worst economic climates that's hit this country in decades. So entertainment generally is one of the things that can still withstand a storm of sorts economically because people need an escape. But if you're doing something on an annual basis, you're giving yourself a challenge because a lot of people look at it like, well, I don't need to see them this time because they're going to be back next year anyway.
Yeah.
And so, where you're gaining new fans, a lot of the people that come to our shows, it's repeat listening value kind of customers who want to see it again and again.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a massive turnover where you got an entirely different audience the next time. So we're gaining and building here and there, but you also have people that are like, yeah, I've seen it a bunch of times. Depends on what material they're going to play this time, and it's a pick and choose kind of thing. So it's a challenge to keep the same amount of people coming out, and the financial guarantees shrink each time, especially in this climate. So, there's all those same kind of issues that affect every business.
Yeah.
But it's something that everybody in the band has come to rely on as part of, if not their entire income, the majority of their income. So, there's a responsibility to keep making the effort to keep people employed. Obviously we enjoy the music, and there's challenges and sacrifices that go with all of it, but by no means is this just one of those things where you just go, yeah, hey, this will be easy. It's a challenge to do any of it and make any money out of it. I mean, Frank generally lost money every time he went on tour, and sometimes, to huge deficits. It's well known he talked about losing more than $300,000 on several tours,
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because that's what it cost to take out the gear that he was taking out and the size of the band and all that stuff. But in his case, he was going to turn it into records that would hopefully make some money back out of that. With the industry being the way that it is, people don't want to pay for music. They want it to all be free. You got all this stuff. So you can't go out and lose money on a tour and expect to make it back by making an album out of it,
Sure.
So everything is different about it now. And people, charge so much money for tickets these days because you have to be in business with people that put all these add-on things and Ticketmaster type stuff and whatever. So it's hard to make a tour appealing to people and then make it also financially viable to do. I know that for me personally, it's a huge struggle, and with the divorce, it's even worse.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I don't really know. I mean, I don't know how you do it. I know that there's a lot of bands out there that have taken, the sort of Clear Channel plan of doing the, issuing the front of house mixes just as is after every show. Like, you can get them, 15 minutes later, and that's supposed to help shore up, your expenses and things like that.
And it's just a bonus upsell thing for people, and in the past, we've been approached to do that kind of stuff, but I have a lot of respect for for the music, and I don't want inferior versions of stuff going out. And as far as you're talking about front of house, you know, in the most recent tours, the front of house mixes have improved quite a bit because the stage volume has lowered, and the way that we are doing certain things has improved the quality of the front of house mixes. And that's not something that was a specific dynamic that I was saying, hey, we have to improve the front of house mixes, but it's a result of other work we did to improve the sound for, you know, the audience who's coming to the shows. But it made it so it is possible to release certain front of house mixes depending on certain venues. I wouldn't say that categorically across the board I would want every front of house mix to be available, but, you know, on the stuff that I have been working on for this upcoming library of front of house mixes and this double CD that I'm working on, you know, I'm going through and systematically picking the best sounding ones, you know. And for people that don't know, front of house mixes generally don't sound that good because they're not intended to be a mix that you would hear as a final product like you would be if you were getting a finished record.
Sure.
They're mixes that are balanced for the venue at the time of the show. So if you have too much bass on stage, if it's really loud coming from the cabinets on stage, you know, in the mix, the bass is going to be a lot more quiet because it's not being put into the PA because it's too loud on stage. So you can have a lot of anemic sounding mixes that don't sound good. We barely hear the bass at all. And, you know, the same can be true for any instrument that's loud on stage. If it's loud on stage, it's going to be less in the PA for the audience to hear because they're hearing some of the sound coming from the stage. And so that kind of balance creates, you know, really weird sounding mixes that don't emphasize the right parts, and you know, I'm not interested in people having those kind of souvenirs. So the ones that do sound more in balance, I have been sort of pulling together to create something with, and I think that this next collection of songs and this double CD that I'm making has a really good combination of things from all throughout the whole catalog. You know, I tried to focus this collection more on some of the more obscure things that we've learned and played that haven't been on every tour. You know, we have a lot of songs that are fan favorites that appear, you know, most of the time on a lot of these tours, you know, because you have to balance new stuff with things that people will recognize so that people can enjoy themselves. If they see a whole show of stuff they don't know, they're not as enthusiastic about it, you know?
Yeah, sure. That actually leads me into the next question that I had, which was about the You Can't Fit on Stage Anymore project. Now, you had what is being called the missive on your site about, you know, kind of pointing all that stuff out to people, you know, who don't know about front of house mixes and things like that. But that stuff is coming, of course.
Well, you know, I pointed out to everybody that there's been all kinds of issues that stood in the way of that being executed the way it was originally described. And it started because there was an issue with the sound quality to begin with.
Yeah.
Where we had a lot of phase cancellation and other weird things that happen. If you were just to have all the mics on all the time and you listen to it that way and you made a mix as it was, it sounded inferior. It didn't really sound good. But when you muted out the problems where other instruments were getting into other instruments' microphones, it improved drastically the sound quality. So that ended up being a lot of extra work, but it ended up being the kind of thing that was necessary to create the kind of quality that I was hoping to achieve with all that stuff. And that can be heard on the Return of the Son of and any of the, you know, the downloads that were already issued.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that coupled with the fact that the original guy that was mixing flaked on the project, and there were delays from the road, and then the whole divorce and all this other stuff. Taking time for all that, I explained it, in pretty good detail about, people say, how could it take 3 years to do these 20 shows? And, the reality of it is that, I said, let's apply this concept of if it takes 28 days to do one show without any days off, and you're working 8 to 10 days, at a time, there's 20 shows to do, so 28 times 20 is 560. There's 365 days in a year. That would be solid working, no time off, trying to get all that stuff done. Now, when you have life that has to continue on, and you have to be able to see your children, and you have to pay the bills and mm-hmm. do other things, you can't keep up that kind of pace. And when the responsibility became mine because the other guy flaked, I didn't intend to mix these things to begin with,
mm-hmm.
but I don't have the resources to farm it out at this point. So I'm doing the best I can to do it when I have the time to do it. Ultimately, it's all about the quality. If I didn't care about the quality, I would have just given the front of house mixes, which sound terrible.
Yeah.
That's the problem. You have only a very small handful of people that are complaining about something, and the fact is, everybody was supposed to get a download of the show that they had a code to, and while the other stuff was being worked on, they got a download of a code that they didn't go to. So they've got a rental car, so to speak, until they get their real car. And, I've provided everybody with the opportunity to have a souvenir in the meantime while the stuff waits. And the majority of people are absolutely fine with that. But you have a couple of, people that have just showing their selfish side and trying to say that, I'm only in it for the money, or I'm only trying to rip them off, or whatever. And then, of course, when they read this blog and they understand all of the other things that are involved and how it is, there's been several people that have apologized for all the rotten things they've been saying because they didn't really get why it was delayed.
Yeah.
The point is, information is really what everybody was seeking, I never thought of it as being a big issue because, we're talking about a free download.
Yeah, that's true. You're not talking about an album that people have paid for, and not
right. People bought tickets, they saw the show, and then they were going to get a souvenir in the form of a free download. The price of the ticket was to see the show, not to how do you pay for something that's free? So people are arguing that they paid for the download. It's like, well, you paid for the show, and you get the free download, but you got something in the meantime until yours is ready, and you got something of a very high quality, and the reason that the delay is there is, first off, because of the quality, then you had the other domino effect, but, my goal was to present it to people so it had a very high quality, so they had a great souvenir from the show. And when people argue, like, oh, the show was so great, and I just wanted to hear it over and over, and that's why I'm so angry I haven't received it, it's like, it just seems like a silly argument to me because, I'm not trying to keep this from people. I'm trying to get this stuff done. Believe me, I'd love to be done with it, but it's, I have a lot of stuff I have to do. I have a lot of responsibilities. You in doing everything with the tour, learning the music, actually going out and doing the shows, you know, there's a lot of time involved in that. There's a lot of time away from my children.
Yeah.
And they're only little one, you know, so ideally I prefer not to be doing all that stuff, but that's the nature of what my business is at this time.
Yeah. You know, it's, you know, I mean, on the other hand, all of your shows are bootlegged anyway. You know, somebody's taping all of your shows all the time. I don't think there's a single show that you've played that isn't out there somewhere. So, you know, those shows are out there to a certain extent if you know where to look for them, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that's the case. I don't spend any time doing it, but, you know, the version that we'll have in the end will be a very high quality version, and
yep.
And that'll be that, you know.
Yeah, and then it'll be done. I wanted to ask you about, you're going to be on the Experience Hendrix tour.
Yep.
How did that come about? That's an interesting fit for
I
you.
I just got a phone call to see if I was interested in it, and I certainly was, because you'd be in a very small minority if you were somebody that said you don't like Jimi Hendrix's music, you know. interestingly enough, I've never sat down to learn any of his music in any detail, so I thought it would be another fun challenge to work on getting those kind of sounds and just having that flavor and texture within my own playing. I thought it would be a fun thing to incorporate and sort of re-energize me musically in a different thing. It's just all about guitar and you know, having some fun, and it just really seems appealing to get a chance to play with these other guitar players. You know, Eric Johnson will be on the tour, Robbie yeah. Krieger, Kenny Wayne Shepherd, Johnny Lang, a bunch of different guys, you know. All kinds of people that, you know, I'll enjoy spending time with, and it'll just really be a fun treat as a guitarist.
How long is the tour for?
I think I'm on tour pretty much all of March.
Okay, so then there'll be the DZPZ tour in February, and then Experience Hendrix in March, and then right back into.
The next thing will be the Australian tour in April, and then, you know, there's some other stuff being decided for the rest of the year. We have some plans for stuff around Dweezilla and summer stuff, as well as some fall possibilities.
You know, before I leave the Experience Hendrix topic, are you going to bring... the Hendrix Strat?
You know, it was something that was, you know, discussed, but it just requires a healthy insurance premium to be paid to get something like that out there and protected, and I don't know that it's going to be something that anybody wants to fork over to do, so don't think that guitar is going to end up on tour, but you know, one of these days I'll have to play it at a show here or there, you know, just to put it to some use.
Hello and welcome to Zappa's Gear, the section of the ZappaCast dedicated to Frank Zappa's guitars, effects pedals, amplifiers and other musical devices. I'm Mick Eakers, and today I'll be talking to Dweezil Zappa about a very special guitar, Jimi Hendrix, Frank Zappa, Stratocaster. This legendary instrument started out as a standard 1963 Sunburst Fender Stratocaster. Jimi Hendrix was playing at the London Astoria on March 31, 1967, as part of a package tour with the Walker Brothers, Cat Stevens and Engelbert Humperdinck. Hendrix had only five numbers with which to make an impression, and at the suggestion of journalist Keith Autham, it was decided to set fire to the guitar at the end of the set. Manager Chas Chandler got a roadie to obtain a bottle of lighter fuel, and at the end of the song Fire, the guitar was ceremoniously torched by Hendrix, to the amazement of the audience and the anger of the Astoria management, who told him he would never play in one of their theatres again. As far as we know, Hendrix only ever burnt one other guitar on stage at the famous Monterey concert later that year, although he smashed many others. Here's an excerpt from the end of that concert, just to give you a taste of what a Fender Stratocaster sound like when it's set on fire while being amplified through a 100-watt Marshall stack turned all the way up. The guitar was kept by Hendrix roadie Howard Parker, also known as H, who gave it to Frank Zappa sometime in 1968. Zappa's original assumption was that it was from the 1968 Miami concert, at which Frank Zappa also played, and this cast some doubts on the guitar's authenticity. H died at sea in 1974 and his body was never found. The story was further complicated when a burnt Stratocaster purporting to be the Astoria model was auctioned in London in September 2008 and purchased for around $500,000. However, comparison with the guitar Hendrix is holding in backstage photographs taken at the Astoria concert reveals this as an obvious fake. We have no reason to doubt that the guitar now owned by Dweezil Zappa is the genuine article. Frank Zappa kept the unplayable relic hanging on his basement wall as an ornament for several years, and then in 1976 he gave it to luthier Rex Bogue and told him to put this sucker back together. In January 1977, Frank Zappa was pictured holding the results on the cover of Guitar Player magazine, looking every inch the rock guitar god. Bogue added a new neck, a Barker's Berry piezo pickup, active electronics, and finished it all off with the shiny mirrored scratch plate, although he retained the blackened and distorted pickup covers from the original guitar. The end result was a very mean-looking machine indeed. In 1978, the guitar was changed yet again. The pickup assembly was replaced with the black units containing three completely different pickups, a Dan Armstrong at the bridge, a Seymour Duncan Strat pickup in the middle, and a Carvin 22-pole humbucker at the neck. A new gold bridge was fitted with a whammy bar, and the neck was replaced with a new maple one. This is the guitar that you can hear on the track Sexual Harassment in the Workplace from the Guitar album. One of my favourite Frank Zappa solos ever, this straight-ahead blues workout seems to embody some of Jimi Hendrix's spirit. I recently had the great pleasure of visiting Dweezil Zappa at his home studio in Los Angeles to interview him for the Zappa's Gear book. This is what he had to say about the Hendrix Strat.
The Hendrix Strat, you know, I grew up seeing it in one form, you know, the way Frank had it on tour in the probably like 1981 period. It had a black pickguard on it, and it had a gold tremolo system, and it had three pickups. It had a humbucker in the back that was a carve-in, and then two other single coils, and you know, it had this bird's eye maple neck that had stars on the neck, and actually stars on the tuners, and then it had like regular you know, fret markers. But the thing was, you know, I had played it when I was 12, and I remember that guitar, and then it sort of disappeared. And I asked Frank, you know, what happened to the guitar? He said, I don't know where it is, you know. And so one day, there's at the studio, there's a staircase that goes from the ground floor, street level, which is there was an area where they would fix gear down there that they called the lab. And behind the lab, there was a smaller storage area that had a bunch of tapes in it and some other gear that was not being used at the time, and a spring reverb thing and part of the echo chamber for the studio. Oh, yeah. So from time to time, you know, some of my stuff ended up in that little room, you know, behind the lab. Yeah. But specifically behind the staircase was just some, you know, unassigned space that had, you know, people were, I guess, just putting random things there. So one day, I just happened to look back there, and there was the Hendrix guitar in pieces, not in a case, just like in pieces, shoved in a corner. And it was like it had been raped and left to die.
Right. You know?
And so I was like, what is going on with this? The electronics were stripped off the pickguard, so yeah, it couldn't be put back together with the parametric that used to be in it. And so, you know, I told Frank that I found it, and he was like, where was it? It says under the stairs, you know, and he's like, I don't even know how it got there. So, you know, the speculation really is that when Frank had work done on his guitars, some of it was done in-house. Midget, Gail's brother, was doing some of the electronics for, like, the parametric EQs and things, and he was not known for, you know, keeping things in good order necessarily when things were a work in progress. So that was always sort of like the ongoing thing was, like, if something needed to be fixed, instead of getting a brand new part, it was like, oh, let me just take a part out of this thing, put it in this. So the gear was just sort of like swirling around with, like, you know, stuff like that. So the Hendrix guitar was just part and parcel to that whole thing. So I guess if, you know, Frank wanted something changed on one of his other guitars, the parts were just taken off that one that he wasn't playing, and then it was just kind of left in the corner. So that, when I found it, you know, I asked him if he wanted me to put it back together, you know, because I could just put it back together just as a normal guitar. But the neck itself had some damage to it because of the way it had been stored in there. It had some nicks and things, and it was rough on the hands. So I decided to have the guys at Fender help put the thing back together. We put this flipped headstock guitar neck on it, so it was sort of a nod to Jimmy.
Yep.
And then I just restored it to what it would have been like if it was a stock guitar, you know, in the mid to late 60s, and I had these Lindy Fralin pickups that were put in it, and so it became that version of the guitar with the tortoiseshell pickguard and the Lindy Fralin pickups and the gold hardware and stuff like that. So that's how it was for a long time.
You can hear Dweezil playing the Hendrix Strat in this, its fourth incarnation, with his band Zappa Play Zappa, performing Peaches on Regalia on the Late Late Show on the 29th of February 2008. Regular listeners to the Zappacast may notice that that is the second time running I've played a version of Peaches on Regalia. I make absolutely no apologies for that. I then went on to ask Tweezil about his latest rebuild of the Hendrix Strat.
So the version that I decided, you know, to do was the way that it's most well known, which is from the cover of Guitar Player in 1977. And I think that's the first time anybody really became aware of that guitar, you know, and its lineage and all that stuff. So I thought, if it's going to go back to any form, why not that, you know? And the trickiest part about that was I had never seen the neck that was on that guitar. Even when I remember the guitar early on, it had this maple neck on it. But, on you know, at that time in 77, it had a rosewood neck on it with some weird colored headstock that also had some strange, like, it looked like, you know, 70s craft working, and, you know, like, it had this thing that would almost look like a shark tooth or something underneath the the strings, and so that was tricky to try to figure out exactly what that was made out of, really what it looked like, because there were no really close-up pictures from anything I found. Niels Losauer, the photographer that took the cover shot, had a couple of extra shots in his vault, so we were able to zoom in a little bit and get some detail. So I took that to, you know, to Fender, and they were able to redo the neck to be as close as possible on, you know, cosmetically for the headstock. But the shape of the neck and everything, I never touched that original neck. So yep. What I did was I had the neck that was formerly on the guitar that I did know, the maple neck, which was a Boogie Bodies neck.
Yeah.
I had that one all measured, and so it's that same neck, you know, design, but with the rosewood fingerboard and that other cosmetic detail. Now, as far as the electronics in it, from what I remember in the guitar, it just had a parametric EQ. You know, it didn't have some of the, and it had the standard thing that he would always have, which was the preamp and the parametric EQ.
Yeah.
So it didn't have any, you know, some of his other guitars had these other three or five way switch things that would go through a rotary of weird mid range stuff, like the Les Paul has some stuff like that, like it's like a wah-wah, you know, in a rotary.
Yeah.
So you could just choose which notch frequency that you want, but this one, just kind of like the smooth EQ that he had, was a three-band parametric EQ. You know, I had performance guitar at some point, performance guitar in Hollywood. Those guys had done a lot of work on Frank's guitars, and they had, you know, Midget originally built those EQ circuits, but they knew how to build those things too. And I had originally got a couple of those circuits built into some pedals. But we took that and then we put it into the Hendrix guitar, so it has that same thing. But what was different was Frank had talked about having a Barkus Berry pickup in the neck of that guitar. So we did that as well, where we took a contact pickup, and you know, it's like, I don't know if he had it actually drilled in at the neck joint where the truss rod is, and had something placed in, or what the deal was, but we decided, rather than do just a regular contact pickup that would have been at that time, we got this thing that's kind of like a one magnet, you know, strip that, it's not the same as what you'd use for a piezo pickup, but it's kind of like what you'd use in a dobro or something, you know, so it's put in. It's put in at the neck joint, and there's a switch, and there's the extra knob on the lower horn, so you have an on-off switch for that extra pickup, and a blend knob to be able to use it. And it's like a really thin, weird acoustic sound that you can add in if you need to. And Frank complained that that guitar, when it had that, was feeding back like crazy, and he couldn't control it. You know,
not surprising, really.
Yeah, so that's, you know, I went to the trouble to get it as close to what it could have been back at that time, you know, but also still be manageable and playable to do what I want to do with it. You know?
Okay. Have you recorded anything with that?
Not yet, because it's still had a few little issues to be worked out with, but I plan to do some stuff with that guitar, you know, because now that it's back to its former glory, you know, why not?
Absolutely. Fantastic.
And that just about wraps up this special edition of Zappa's Gear. Many thanks indeed to Dweezil Zappa for being so generous with his time, and thanks, of course, to Chris Davis Jr. for engineering and putting the whole thing together. If this sort of stuff is interesting to you, please do check out the Zappa's Gear website at zappasgear.com, dedicated to the book of the same name that I am writing on this very subject. Okay, guys, one more time for the world.
People would like to see it. What happened?
Well, I would play Watermelon and Easter Hay on it one day.
Oh wow! Well, yeah, that would be a good use for it.
Yeah.
Is that going to be coming back into the? Or is that going to be coming into the sets anytime soon?
You know, I would love for it to be part of it at some point, but you know. Ultimately, for me, it's still an emotional song that you know I have to be able to work my way through, not only just to play it, but to work through the emotional side of it.
Yeah, well, because I know there's a couple of songs like that that are considered, you know, kind of sacred songs and guitar pieces, and you know, certainly that's one of them. I didn't know if I always wanted to ask you actually if you had any plans to do that, so that kind of answers that. I wanted to ask you about what happened with the gold top Les Paul too.
It didn't sell.
No.
And there's, you know, continuing legal situations trying to still get that back into our possession. You know, I don't really have anything specific that I can talk about on it, but you know, it would be our greatest hope that that we could get it back.
I mean, as far as you know, it's stolen, correct?
Yeah, that's what I've always been told by Frank, and he said it in multiple interviews. You know, there's documentation of all that kind of stuff. But you know, there's all kinds of legal points of view on how to get it back, and that one of these days, you know, can be commented on, but not at this time.
Okay. Yeah, that's a fascinating guitar for me because, you know, obviously Frank modded it very heavily.
Yeah.
You know, that's another one of those guitars that's pretty much the only vintage guitar that's missing, correct? I think.
You know, he's had other things that were stolen over time, and then, you know, but as far as vintage ones go, I think you're right.
Yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you about Dweezilla. What's going on for Dweezilla this year? I know the dates got moved, but...
moved them to the 4th of July weekend to make it more family-friendly and give people a chance to come. You know, our experience has been that, you know, there's some people that would like to come, but then think, well, I can't really take the time for my family.
Yeah.
But, you know, this gives them a chance to come with their family and make it a family thing, even if they're not actually, you know, family members participating in the music classes. There's other things for them to do this time around. And so we're trying to make it as easy for people to participate in it as possible. and ultimately it's been a really fun experience. It's just, you know, if something like that would have existed at the time that I started playing guitar, I would have been, you know, thrilled to have a chance to do something like that. You know, if Eddie Van Halen had a guitar camp, you know, it would have been like the most awesome thing ever, you know, at 12 years old. But but anyway, you know, this kind of total immersion, 3-4 day experience where, you know, you're in classes and you have a chance to perform stuff and all that, it's just a really fun experience for people, and it's fun for us too. And I think we're going to focus a little bit more on putting together certain kind of curriculum things where different people in the group will mentor a certain group of students, and then at the end of the whole camp, they will have all learned to perform a particular piece of music. You know, and again, you know, what we do there is not based on Frank's music, it's just music, you know. So, you know, I think that people will enjoy the opportunity to further their education and break free from some of the you can get into as a musician. You know, I think Dweezil offers a lot to people that want to take things more seriously, and also to the beginners that want to get a chance to get set on a path that will help them improve more quickly, you know, and that's really the goal in all of this, is to make it fun and give people a chance to improve and have a better understanding.
So will families be able to, you know, to stay at the resort, or how's the family?
Yeah, it's all based on you know, how you choose your reservations. There's a number of rooms at the resort, and then there's rooms at hotels that are nearby, and then there's camping, and there's all kinds of stuff. So that all changes, you know, how much it costs. But generally speaking, you know, it's for what it is, it's a pretty affordable kind of total immersion package for the kind of access you have to the people that you have access to.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know what the most expensive version of the package is, but I think it's like $2,500. But you're talking about 4 days, all, you know, accommodations, food, classes, all that kind of stuff. And so, you know, if you compare that to going to Disney World or any of these other things, you know, you'd probably be spending at least that or more, but you get some other kind of, you know, things that appeal to your life that can actually give you some impetus to, you know, further your own career and whatnot.
Yeah, I'd like to actually do more stuff for this podcast, you know, about Dweezil as we get closer to it, because I just think it's good, you know, promotionally speaking, for the event. Because I think there's a lot of people who don't really understand necessarily what it is. So, you know, that would be good for them to hear a little bit about that, you know, if that's cool with you.
Yeah, I'm hoping to actually put a couple little video things on the site that will show, you know, portions of at least my class, and give people a sense of what goes on.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. I have a couple of questions here from Andrew Greenaway, who, for practical considerations, isn't doing the interview because, as you can tell, I'm a horrible interviewer, but he's a lot better. Because when I talk to you, we just talk, you know. But he's sort of more professional, so he had a couple of questions for you.
Hi, Dweezil. When I interviewed Steve Vai a few years ago, we talked about Frank's song Solitude. He said he thought Gail wanted you to record it. Do you have any plans to do just that?
I'm not sure if that is an accurate representation. If as I understand what you just said, Steve said that Frank wanted me to perform that song or record that song?
Oh, Gail wanted you to record it.
I mean, I've never had a discussion with Gail about that song, but I know it's a little-known song in Frank's catalog, and it's a song written for Gail.
Yep.
You know, something I could think about, but I actually haven't ever had that conversation with Gail. It's news to me.
Ah, yeah. Well, I'm glad I could provide some news for you. The other question he had was,
on the version of Staying Alive, released on Ozzy Osbourne's Prince of Darkness box set, the drum and bass tracks have been re-recorded. How did that come about?
Well, there are certain elements in that I changed on purpose, because what happened with that track to begin with was Ozzy sang on it, and it was supposed to be on my Confessions record, but
yep.
Then Sharon or somebody at the record company decided they didn't want Ozzy to be on it. And they said, you have to destroy that track and get rid of his vocal and all that stuff. And I said, well, you know, that's unfortunate because I think he sounds great on it. So I put Donny Osmond on instead of Ozzy. But then years later, they're making this box set, and somebody tipped me off that they had my original version on it, and they were just going to kind of do it without talking to me about it, you know, just put this thing out on there. So to make it different than the original version, I added some new things to it to make it specific to that box set. And, you know, I kept the original version for myself for whenever I'm going to release something. So there's a difference between some stuff, you know. So I just wanted to add a couple of different textures to that version that ended up on that Ozzy one.
Okay. Who was playing? Who did the overdubs on it? On the bass and drum overdubs? Did you?
The drums are as they were, you know. But there's just additional programming, like MIDI programming stuff that I did.
And now on the Zappacast, we have a little wonderful musical interlude for you. We've got a song from the brand new Dweezil Zappa album FOH, now available at DweezilZappaWorld.com. This is What's New in Baltimore, and that will be followed by The Black Page number 2, which is taken from the 2008 album Zappa Plays Zappa. At the start of the show, by the way, you heard The Black Page number 1, which was a drum piece performed by Terry Bozzio. So here on the Zappacast, What's New in Baltimore and The Black Page number 2. Thank you.
Kingston. Hey! What's new in Baltimore? Seriously, I don't know. Hey! What's new in Baltimore?
Hello, my little crepe Suzettes. The idiot bastard here with a little drop of news for all that ails you. As ever, if you want to find out more about any of this old crud, just click onto idiotbastard.com. Okay, fix up, look sharp. Since my last update, we learnt of another loss. Grand Wazoo and Reuben and the Jets Sly guitarist Tony Duran sadly passed away in December following a battle with prostate cancer. And on that very subject, a very intriguing article about an alternative treatment Frank received for his prostate cancer can now be vidded online. Seems Gail took Frank to see touch therapist Dean Kraft sometime in 1989, after he'd been told he had just 2 months to live. There's a testimonial from Gail, and it is evident that they believe Kraft helped prolong Frank's life. Last time out, I mentioned that Alice Cooper would be headlining the final day at Zappanali in August, that Sunday being Heavy Guitar Day. The headline act for the festival proper will be the Brothers of Invention, George Duke and Jean-Luc Ponty, who should be playing all the hits from the King Kong album. CPZ are very busy this year. Already they've played the West Coast with Scott Tuners on bass. In April they're playing Down Under, introducing new bassist Kurt Morgan. Then in June and July they have a North American tour set up, including, with fingers crossed, a second Roundhouse festival. Also in April, the Grandmothers, who seem to have reinvented themselves once more and are now calling themselves the Grandmothers of Invention, will be touring the US with Tom Fowler. Hopefully most of you now know the fate of the band's former bassist. Terry Bozzio has a new double CD of all new material recorded on his solo tour of 2007 called Live in Japan 2007. And Chad Wackerman has just released Dreams, Nightmares and Improvisations, an album featuring the mighty Alan Holdsworth. Finally, let's play a little game, shall we? In December, Ryko Disc announced that it had lost the rights to Zappa. Since then, the ZFT has been purging the internet of unauthorised recordings of the Maestro's works, notably on YouTube. Next, Gail says, imagine you have to fight every day just to preserve the music in the manner in which the composer intended it. Imagine you could buy it back. Imagine you have to, because that is who you are, and that is what it is. Okay, got all that? What does this mean? What's the meaning of this? Tune in next time and hopefully all will be clear. Now bugger off.
And one last bit of rather sad news that came in very late in the day. We are very sad to report that keyboardist Andre Lewis, who played in the final Mothers of Invention lineups in 1975 and 1976, passed away on January 31st. Our sympathies go out to Andre's family. That's our show. Thank you very much for listening. The Zappacast was produced and edited by Scott Parker, Andrew Greenaway,
and Mick Eakers.
Be sure to check out Andrew's website at www.idiotbastard.com for all the latest Zappa news, and also to purchase Andrew's book, Zappa the Hard Way, the definitive account of the 1988 Frank Zappa Broadway the Hard Way tour. For those of you interested in obtaining my Zappa books, my website is located at www.spbpublishing.webs.com. And if you order the books directly from me, I'll sign them for you. My books are also available from www.gndsmusic.com, purveyors of the finest Zappa merchandise anywhere, as well as www.amazon.com and many other right-thinking booksellers.
And you should also check out Mick Eaker's excellent site on Frank's gear at www.zappasgear.com.
If you wish to contact us, drop us a line at MOI1969, that's 1969, at snet.net. On behalf of Andrew Greenaway
and Mick Eakers,
this is Scott Parker saying thank you again for listening. And until next time, good night, boys and girls.
Thanks a lot. Good night.